Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome along to episode 7 of the Drive Nation podcast. I'm Dan Prosser, joined as ever by Andrew Frankel. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Yeah, very well. We're still recording this remotely. We still can't get together to do these in person, but I think we're making it work. And with this episode of the podcast, Andrew, we're talking about McLaren. Plenty to discuss there, I think. What springs to mind when you first hear McLaren? Are you thinking fast cars or are you thinking Formula One?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think fast cars, which is interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, 10 years ago, it would have just been Formula One. I think that probably says a lot about the way that people like you and me live our lives. You know, McLaren Automotive as opposed to McLaren F1 is very much sort of front and centre of a journalist's life. But I guess the reason that we're doing this podcast now, or I guess just the hook for it, is that there was and we posted about this and got an amazing response yesterday. There was an auction, wasn't there, on the Collecting Cars website of a 720S. Yep. And this was a £250,000 car, which ended up going for half price, despite the fact it was 2 years old. It had a really nice spec on it, 50 grand's worth of extras, only done 5,000 miles, I think. And I think we thought that this is a time to talk about McLaren, talk about some of the, I think, concerns that some people rightly or wrongly have about the brand, and then, you know, use that to sort of expand into a sort of a wider understanding of, you know, what McLaren Automotive is, where it's come from, and I guess most important of all, where we think it either is going to or should be going to.
Yeah, because that one Collecting Cars auction that finished last week, that's kind of McLaren Automotive in microcosm, isn't it? This wonderful supercar, really highly regarded, that we all think is just spectacular to drive, selling for half price after 2 years, which speaks of some of the issues that McLaren is having with residual values and all the rest of it. So it kind of combines everything that's great and not so great about McLaren into one auction.
Yeah, and I think something else that we ought to be looking at is, you know, there's a lot of talk about McLaren and their particular issues, and I'm sure there are some, but also, you know, I'm not sure that it isn't a wider problem than that. And sure. I think that there are some misconceptions, or maybe that there are some views which maybe were current and valid once, but maybe the world has, or McLaren has changed a bit since then. So hopefully we'll talk a bit about that too.
Of course. So the 720S was a performance model, as you said, 5,000 miles. It sold for £124,500. There's a buyer's premium on top of that. So the buyer actually paid £130,500. That still undercut the cheapest 720 that I could find for sale in the UK by around £10,000. So what's your instinct there, Andrew? Do you think that really was a bargain basement 720S, or is that now the market value for that car?
Interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think you know, what that says to me is that what these cars are being advertised for on all the sites that you and I probably spend too much time on probably isn't or shouldn't be much of an indication of what the actual transaction price is. And I think that actually that says an awful lot about you know, the way the market in general is at the moment. I mean, obviously, we know we're living in the most extraordinary times. Everybody is worried about not just, you know, the here and now, but, you know, how things are going to be, whether they're going to be able to earn a living, whether they're going to have any money. And I just think that buying cars like that is just not very high up most people's agendas. And that always means, doesn't it, you know, the demand goes down, the supply stays constant, that, you know, the price goes down too. So, you know, I think that actually, you know, if you looked at that collecting cars thing, you know, there were lots of viewers, there were lots of, you know, registered watchers, there were quite a few. I think there were 26 bids on the car. I can't think of any reason to think that that, in these circumstances, at this time, was not, you know, the right price for that car.
Yeah, I think that the car found its audience, didn't it?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And as we know, you know, collecting cars is, you know, it's a pretty new concept, but it's going great guns. I think they've just done £6 million worth of business. And, you know, I think that if you were going to go and buy a car like that, you would be aware of that auction and that you would, you know, that you would be switched onto it. So, no, I think it is a fair price. But whether that says more about, you know, the McLaren or more about the market is another conversation. I feel inclined at the moment to think that it probably says much more about where the market is relative to where we are used to it having been for the last few years than anything else.
Yeah, I suspect it's a COVID-19 price, isn't it, really, rather than a sort of McLaren price. There were, as ever, Andrew, we had lots of really insightful comments in response to your post. They quite clearly demonstrate that lots of DNers are pretty switched on about the supercar market. They clearly, a good number of them, buy and sell these cars. So there's lots of insight in the comments. A few people said they saw this coming, and perhaps that's fair. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about oversupply of McLaren supercars, and also the market just turned upside down by this COVID-19 situation. So lots of people say that they suspected this was going to happen, and they think it's going to happen even more. Do you think we're looking at a new normal? Are we over the next few months just like to see lots of bargains here and there?
Yeah, I do. And you know, and the thing is, it's always the way, isn't it? When things suddenly turn to crap, the very, very small number of people who are in a position to take advantage of that, i.e. they have the cash and can still buy these cars, they're the guys who are going to, you know, obviously make the most of it. I think there will be a new normal, but I don't think this is it. I think, to be honest with you, I think things may fall a little bit more. And then I think that inevitably there will be a correction. So, you know, you have to look at where it plateaus out. But, you know, I am fairly confident that wherever that plateau is, it's going to be some distance below where we have, you know, got nice and, you know, comfortable with it being. And I think that times are going to be harder. And I think that makers of cars, not just McLaren by any means, but, you know, if you are in the, you know, super high luxury market, as these guys are, you know, you are going to be looking about, you know, taking stock out of your system about, frankly, in future making, you know, a smaller number of cars and trying to sell them for, you know, as much as you can, because I don't think that the old rules apply anymore.
Mm. If I, speaking personally, if I had any intention of moving my car on anytime soon, actually I intend to keep it for a very long time, this would all be very concerning, because presumably an Alpine A110 is worth about £20 now.
I don't know, actually, because there are so few of them around.
That's a relief.
I don't know. I, to be honest, I haven't looked. But I'll tell you what I do think. I think it strikes at the heart of why I think people should buy cars, which is, frankly, you should buy a car because you want to have that car. If you want to have a car, if you want to have a 720S because you just love the idea of having a 720S and having, in inverted commas, had one for a bit myself last year, that is something I get completely. If you want a car like that, then you can't really lose as long as you can keep up with the repayments, because, you know, if it depreciates, as, you know, almost all non-limited edition, in fact, all non-limited edition standard production cars do, then you still got the car and you can go and enjoy it. If you make some money out of it, fine. But if not, you've just got the car. Just go and enjoy it. I think the people who lose most, frankly, are the people who do to be honest, you know, 5,000 miles in 2 years. So you've not had a huge amount of enjoyment out of the car. You've taken a massive hit on it. And, you know, and what for? So, you know, if I had a 720S, I'd never sell it. I wouldn't do 5,000 miles, and I'd do 50,000 miles, 100,000 miles in it, because, you know, why wouldn't you? I mean, you know, it would mean more to me than anything else that that thing was just sitting out there, you know, at my beck and call. And gosh, you know, what a lucky boy I would feel.
Exactly the way I feel about my car, yeah. Now, you touched on that, Andrew. You were lucky enough to run a 720S for, was it 6 months?
Yeah, 6 months, yeah. First 6 months of last year.
And presumably it was in and out of the dealership the whole time. It set itself. It wouldn't start. It locked you in it.
I never saw it, actually. It sort of turned up one day on a truck, and it never got off the truck. It just turned around and stripped it. No. I have, you know, I know that enough people who, you know, who are not making mischief have said that they've had, you know, big problems. There was one bloke who said he had one for 6 weeks and it was in the garage for five of them. But I, you know, as a journalist and as a reporter, I can only report as I find. This car came to me for 6 months. I absolutely mullered it. I thrashed it round tracks. I took it to Geneva and back over the Alps fast as I could. And there was one day where it flashed up a warning that the headlights were no longer able to see around corners. and it never did it again. And that in 6 months of really, really hard driving is literally, it wasn't even something that went wrong with it. It was literally the only thing it flashed up of any description. Other than that, it behaved like a, you know, anything you like, a Volkswagen Golf in terms of its reliability, and it felt as solid on the last day as the first. It was perfect. I think quite clearly, you know, McLaren, you mustn't forget, McLaren is still a very, very young company. McLaren Automotive is. You know, they are still learning, and I think that, you know, with a car like that, I think that there were some early software issues which needed patching. I believe that's all been done. And you and I, Dan, you know, we drive McLaren press cars a lot, and I'm sure those press cars are built as well as McLaren can build them. But, you know, I don't think I've ever been let down by any McLaren I've driven. And you know what McLaren press launches are like. You know, you go to a track and you go, and, you know, those cars spend not a few hours, but days, and, you know, sometimes a couple of weeks basically being thrashed around tracks. And I've never known one of them break, which is more than I can say for a lot of other brands.
Yeah, true. I mean, there has been a recall, hasn't there? There are reports of certain McLarens being a little bit frail, but based on our own experiences, they've been pretty tough and durable. Now, Andrew, I wonder if you have a bit of insight to shed on this. There are people discuss McLaren and Aston Martin and their approach to shifting new cars into the market. Lots of people say that they do things similarly, perhaps make the same mistakes. There's a suggestion that both companies will heavily discount new cars, will put artificially high guaranteed future values on them, and that gets the punters into the showrooms, that gets cars flying out of the, you know, off the forecourts. It makes the sales figures for the year look good, but the consequence is that later down the road, you're not earning as much revenue as you might do because you're giving very heavy discounts on these cars. And then when the car comes back to you and it's actually not worth as much as the guaranteed future value, you as a company suddenly owe the finance company a big chunk of cash. A bit of a nod of the head to the YouTube channel JM on Cars here. Is that something that you've heard discussed before, that sort of way of operating?
Yeah, it's something like you, I have heard discussed. Whether it is true or not, or to what extent it is true, I don't know. You know, I'm not a consumer journalist. It's not an area which, you know, maybe I should have greater expertise than I do, because I think it would, it may go some way to explaining these issues and shedding more light on how real they are or how maybe just perceived they are. But no, it's not something that I have a lot of experience of. But I do know, and, you know, we've seen it with other companies. We saw it with Bentley in the, you know, early 2000s, when suddenly, you know, they had this thing called the Continental GT, and suddenly for the first time literally in its life, Bentley could make as many cars as it could sell the lot, and so it did. And it oversupplied the market. And, you know, because there were too many cars out there, when things got a bit, you know, things suddenly got extremely tough for them, and it hit residuals, and they had to work very, very hard to recover that position. It's very tempting, isn't it? If, you know, if you're a new company, or if you're a company like Aston Martin, which has had a torrid time, and suddenly you find yourself with product you can sell, the temptation just to get them out there, is entirely understandable, particularly when you have, you know, investors banging down your door, you know, wanting a return on their investment. But, you know, I think we have seen, you know, over the years, you know, that in the long term, it does tend to come back on and bite you on the arse somewhat.
Yeah, and it demonstrates, both in the case of Aston Martin and McLaren, that very, very good product isn't enough to prop up, you know, a sizable business, is it? It takes some very deft supply management and after sales as well to keep investors happy, to keep customers happy and coming back for more.
Yeah, and also, you know, I think that it's interesting, isn't it, that, you know, if the two brands that you alighted upon, and which, you know, the other one we have discussed in a previous podcast, Aston Martin and McLaren, you know, I don't think, certainly at the moment, there is such a thing as a bad car that either of those company makes. You know, I think that they both make, I think they both understand the sorts of cars that they should be making and are making them. What those two companies have in common, however, is they, neither of them has a big, big backer. You know, neither of them has a Volkswagen behind them. So nobody, not, they don't have that, you know, that corporate arm around their shoulders. And so they are inevitably going to be more exposed to the way the market is behaving than another company like a Lamborghini, which at the end of the day is owned by the largest car company in the world. So, you know, it obviously, you know, makes things more important and potentially more difficult for them.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's rewind a little bit. Depending on how you measure it, McLaren Automotive is now a decade old, thereabouts. What do you remember from, say, the mid-noughties? Do you remember whispers, Andrew, of McLaren Automotive setting up as a car company in its own right? Or had those whispers been going on for years and years?
Well, I suppose, you know, they, you know, they obviously, you know, they did the F1, and that totally, you know, established McLaren in our understanding as a manufacturer of road cars, and then obviously they went from that to do the SLR, you know, the whatever it was the Mercedes-Benz AMG SLR McLaren. I think that's what they. I can always remember thinking it was a bit of a poor show that, despite the fact that McLaren engineered the car, despite the fact that it was built in Woking, that the word McLaren was like the last name on a very long list of names that this car had. So, you know, I guess in our perceptions, they never really stopped doing it. And it didn't seem like such a leap that they would go from doing a car like that for somebody else to doing, you know, perhaps rather cars which are rather more appropriate to the McLaren brand for themselves. So it wasn't like a sort of, oh, my goodness, McLaren are going to go and do road car, because, you know, they'd done their own road car before. It had become the most revered road car of them all, and then they'd done a load of stuff for somebody else. So no, it wasn't a big surprise. I guess the bigger surprise was when the, as it was known at the time, the McLaren MP4 12C came out, shortly to become just the 12C. What a frankly patchy product it was when it was new. You know, yeah, you may come out, you launch yourself as an effectively an all-new car company, and you'd think that job one was to make sure that the product was as good as you could possibly get it. And in this case, that didn't happen.
I remember seeing the 12C for the first time. It was before that, sorry, the MP4-12C for the first time. And this was before it had been unveiled in public. And a bunch of journalists, myself included, this must have been 2009, perhaps 08, I think 09, and we had to go down to Woking to the McLaren MTC, isn't it? And we'd be told that we would be shown this new supercar that we'd all heard so much about, but none of us had seen. And so we went into that little sort of theatre room that they have at the MTC, and the MP412C was unveiled to us. And I was so excited about the idea of McLaren Automotive at that point. And I remember feeling perhaps a little bit underwhelmed when we saw this car for the first time, but before any of us had seen any pictures of it, there it was in the flesh. And I thought it was slightly derivative, a little bit sort of unambitious from a styling point of view, for this new and incredibly ambitious arm of McLaren. I didn't get to drive it first time around. I did later on. But perhaps, Andrew, you can talk us through your first impressions. Tell us where you were when you first drove it and what you thought.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I was in the minority. I quite liked the way that it looked, because to me, I mean, I can remember somebody describing it as looking like a bad Korean concept car. And I just thought that was not fair. And actually, I drove one again quite recently, and, you know, as much as the way that it drove, I still like the way they look. To me, it just looked really, really clean and neat. I didn't think the back end was brilliant, but anyway, that's not really the question you asked me. I drove it. I have two memories of early drives, which are a little bit conflicting with each other. The first one, I literally just went to the McLaren Technology Centre and borrowed one, and I drove it down to Goodwood, not on the track, but just around the roads down there, because I know them very well and they were close and I didn't have an awful lot of time. And, you know, you won't find anybody who drove one of those things for the first time and wasn't completely, utterly blown away by the way it got down a road, and the way that super, super clever suspension system worked. No anti-roll bars, you know, interactive. And it just seemed to sort of resurface the road in front of you. And I think from that point of view, it was an immensely clever car. It was fabulously fast. You know, we think it's 10 years ago and how many cars have come out. And, you know, and I think there's temptation to think the 12C was a bit sort of, you know, by modern terms, McLaren light. It's not. Even today, you go and drive a 12C today, properly fast car, you know, very light, 600 horsepower, loads of torque. It went like the wind. But at the same time, just feeling, you know, more that I admired it more than I loved it. And then the next time I drove it was at the, you'll know this, the Autocar. Well, they call it Britain's Best Driver's Car, but everybody at Autocar calls it Handling Day. And it turned up to one of those at Rockingham, and it just didn't work. I couldn't believe it. In the one environment you would expect a McLaren to be head and shoulders above everything else, it just didn't work. It felt remote. It did some slightly strange things. You know, it felt, it didn't feel set up for someone like me, who is, you know, a reasonably, well, very experienced, I guess, and, you know, reasonably good driver, but not a superhero. And I didn't, you know, and the one thing that you will, as you will know, is that, you know, before you can drive a car like that fast, it has to make you confident. You have to have confidence in the machinery. And I just didn't. I can remember there was one, when we came to do the scores, there were loads of judges, and I can't remember which one it was, but I can remember that one of the judges placed it below a Corsa VXR in his estimation. Yeah, so it wasn't great, really. And then the twin test came out with the, oh, it would be the 458, wouldn't it? The Ferrari 458. And I can't remember the McLaren winning one. And us all thinking, blimey, you know, what have they done? Have they, you know, had they literally, to mix my metaphors furiously, come out the gate and drop the ball? And that's what it felt like. And I've always said that the most extraordinary thing about what happened to McLaren thereafter was that they actually recovered not from ground zero, but from actually below that, because, you know, it would have been much easier if the 12C had never been launched like it was, because it was, you know, the car just, it wasn't right in terms of its quality and it wasn't right in terms of the way that it drove. And when you're up against something as, you know, ferociously capable as a 458 from a company with a reputation like Ferrari, it just wasn't good enough. And then, as we know, you know, Anthony Sheriff, who was the man who was a genius in terms of envisaging the concept for cars like you know, the 12C and, you know, and particularly the P1, he left the company. I'm not sure why, but I'm sure most of us can guess. And then Mike Fluitt came in. And Mike would be the first to tell you that, you know, he is not a gifted car engineer, but he knows how to get cars built. And, you know, he understood what the problems was and took that raw material, turned it into the 650S, and, you know, the P1 came out, and the rest we know.
Yeah, and I remember when the 12C was still current, when it was new perhaps, and I think it was Ron Dennis who quite publicly stated that it was a superior motor vehicle to the 458 in every measurable way or something.
And you thought that you've absolutely identified why you've completely missed the point of those cars.
Exactly right. It kind of felt a bit like Ron's supercar, didn't it? But then, I mean, there was some stuff about it that was really wonderful, as you've said. And then they updated it with the 650S, new styling, reworked a lot of the chassis systems and so on, the steering in particular, and it was a much better car to drive.
Yeah, 650S was. The 650S to me is kind of where it started. You know, a 12C is interesting. I mean, I drove one quite recently, and as I said, and it's still. It's still a really impressive car. I still didn't love it, but you know, you can get, you know, from a value point of view, you know, if you think that 720S was cheap, geez, I mean, you know, for half what they paid for that 720S, you know, you can get a 12C now. I think they're in the 60s.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
So, you know, that's a lot of car. That's an awful lot of car. And of course, you still have to worry about what happens if you get a big bill, where you're going to service it, and everything else. But you know, a McLaren for the price of, you know, whatever it is, you know, an up-spec Cayman is quite a tempting proposition. But you know, the 650S, that was just great. It was cliche coming. You know, the car, the 12C, should have been from the get-go. And, you know, and then suddenly that just, I think that car, I think McLaren, because it was so new, I think that there was, I think so many people wanted it to succeed. I think that there was a sense that, okay, fine, you know, they've had their practice car, this is the real thing, and it was amazing. 650S, absolutely fantastic car. And I can remember I drove a 650S out to Geneva and back. It would have been, I suppose, 3 years ago. It was right in its sort of dying days, maybe 2 years ago. And thinking, they don't need to replace this car. And there was this other one coming along. I'm thinking, well, how do they do better than that? And then they did the 720S, and we found out the answer to that question.
Yeah. I thought the 650S was incredibly capable. But the first time I really loved driving a McLaren was the 675LT. I'll tell you about my first ever experience with that car a little bit later on. But what did that car demonstrate to you?
The LT was just something else, wasn't it? It wasn't just a great car. It was a great, great McLaren, because it was all about the driving experience. And it proved that concept of just get the weight out of it. You know, 100 kilograms lighter than the already extremely light 650S. And it was such a, I can remember having one up at Anglesey for a day or two, and just thinking to myself, you know, I can't imagine, you know, me having, you know, significantly more fun than this in a car that I can also get into and, you know, and drive a long distance on the public road. I mean, to me, that is what a McLaren road car should be. It should be a car that is, you know, ultimately and utterly rewarding to drive, but which you can also use. And, you know, that for me is why, for instance, a 675LT is a much better product, and more to the point, a much better McLaren than something like a Senna, which is obviously, you know, incredible and amazing to drive on a track, but it's very, very limited in its use.
Yeah. And then, of course, after 675LT, McLaren followed it up with the Sports Series models, which they're all just wonderful cars. They're stunning to drive. Also, the P1, which you and I will agree, I'm sure, is a spellbinding machine. We'll talk about that a little bit more. And then also the 720. So, ever since the 650S, ever since the 650S, I think the cars that they've come along with have been really first rate, haven't they? So generally speaking, Andrew, where do you stack McLarens up alongside Ferraris and Lambos? Are they sort of nipping at their heels, or are they actually well clear?
I mean, at the worst, they are heads held high in that company. I would, Lamborghini, for me, an SVJ Aventador in the right circumstances, on the right road. I mean, there's no car has a greater sense of occasion than that.
You're right. It is incredible. I stepped out of it, having driven it in North Wales, shaking. It was unbelievable.
But it's what I was going back to what I was saying about the, the car being usable. The rest of the time, it just makes life, just too difficult for you. And, and the fact is that certainly I suspect that anybody would be, certainly somebody like me, I'd just be much quicker point to point in a 720S. I'd be more confident driving, and ultimately I would, although there would be less sort of majesty and theatre about it, I'd have a richer driving experience. So for me, Lamborghinis are, to be honest, not quite there. Against Ferraris, they're absolutely nip and tuck. I would say that, I haven't driven an F8 Tributo, but I've driven a Pista, and obviously I've driven a lot of 488s. I would say, for me, a 720S is slightly more my cup of tea than those, although I love the Pista, and I love the 488 GTB. A Pista is, for me, it takes away a bit too much for what little it actually adds to that experience. But that's a very personal thing. I felt the same way about the Speciale relative to the 458. I always thought a standard 458 was the most miraculous of cars. And it comes back because it's just so much more usable. You have Ferrari, which have been making road cars for the thick end of 70 years. And here comes McLaren Automotive, and in 10 years, actually in less than that, because they've been at that level for a while, probably since the LT first came out, I would say that Ferraris and McLaren are absolutely nose-to-nose at the moment.
Yeah, completely agree. So let's talk about the P1, because McLaren Automotive turned out this hybrid hypercar within half a decade, wasn't it, really, of the company being founded?
A lot less. I think P1 was 2013.
Yeah. So really only going for a few years before they delivered this spectacular car with really innovative technology. It looked, still looks sensational. I think for me, the best looking of the Holy Trinity, as they're called, the 918 Spider and the LaFerrari. I think it's the most attractive of the lot. It's also the only one that I've driven. So perhaps I'm, for that reason, slightly swayed towards it. But wow, what a driving experience that thing delivers.
I think what was amazing about it, I can remember talking to the guys at McLaren about it, and when they decided to do it, they genuinely didn't have a single person in the business who'd ever done anything involving a hybrid. They had no idea. They literally did not have the slightest clue how to do it. And so they just thought, well, okay, we need to find out. And so we'll go and talk to some people, and we'll go and hire some people, and we'll do some research ourselves. And they came up with this, frankly, ridiculous machine, 903 horsepower, and all the DRS, push to pass, plug it in, drive it on electrical. I mean, every single function of an electric hybrid was there in this insane hypercar, and more besides, because it would do that that suspension thing where it would. It would just drop, it would just halve its ride height and whatever, it would triple its downforce when you went into track mode, and it would become a completely different car all over again. I think it's one of the cleverest cars I've ever driven, and knowing a little bit about its gestation, I think it's one of the most impressive achievements. Of the three, and having been, so I'm not trying to kind of pull rank here or be smart, but I have been very lucky enough to drive all three. It's certainly, of the three, the most focused and the one that I would choose to drive around a track. The Holy Trinity is another conversation altogether, but I think each of them has their place, let's put it that way. But I thought a staggering achievement, P1.
It's interesting being a car journalist, because you'll first hear a rumour of this new car coming along, and then a very small select group of people will get to fly out somewhere exotic to drive it. And it just seems impossible that you'll ever get your hands on one of these machines. And then inevitably, well, if you're working on the right title, you do. And I remember it must have been, 3 years after the P1 was first launched, at Evo magazine, I finally got to drive one. And I didn't just drive one. I had it for a day up in North Wales. We had Anglesey Circuit, and it was mine for the day. And it blew me away.
Your grandchildren simply won't believe it. The world that they are going to live in, and you're going to say, yeah, when I was, you know, in my 20s, there I was with this insane device, and it didn't come with chaperones and rules and everything else. There were the best roads in the country. There was this incredible racetrack. It was mine, and I could do whatever the hell I liked with it. I mean, you know, we've both been doing this for years and years, and it still sounds like dreamland, doesn't it?
Yeah. One of the best days in this line of work I've ever had, no question. And so I spent a couple of hours in the morning driving it on circuit in track mode, and I rather than this terrifying sort of malevolent beast, I found this incredibly welcoming, exciting, but, you know, very manageable hypercar. And I just remember having all the systems off and skidding it around Anglesey, and just finding it so sort of malleable. And I couldn't believe that this £1 million 900 horsepower hypercar could be driven that way. It was astonishing.
Yes. Well, I mean, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, but that's the McLaren way of doing things, isn't it? I mean, have you ever been in a McLaren, which is actually a Senna on the road does scare me a bit, but only if you're stupid enough to turn all the traction control off, because it's so stiff and it does ping off everything. And if you try to use all 800 horsepower, then, you know, you can find yourself, you know, quite busy. But that's more to do with you being an idiot than any fundamental shortcoming in the car. But no, I mean, I think unless you're an idiot, you just shouldn't get scared in there, because they are so well developed these days, by people who just understand what's needed. And yeah, I think they're just brilliant. Can I just tell a quick P1 story? I was the first journalist to get to drive the P1 GTR, so the sort of the track day version. And for some reason, the only place that I could drive it was in Qatar. So the P1 GTR, it was amazing. I'm not going to dwell on it because it's not core to the McLaren story, but 1,000 horsepower, a bit lighter than the road car, you know, stack more downforce. I mean, as amazing as you might find. But what really made me realise just what a lucky boy I was, and just what a ridiculously fortunate thing I was able to be out there doing it, was that they gave me a P1 to learn the track.
Just to warm yourself up.
Literally, they said, well, you know, you haven't been here before and you don't want to be thinking about which way the track goes, so you better go out and learn it. Take this. and they gave me a P1 to learn the track, and it was just completely insane. But then, and this is something that I found so often with sort of, you know, race versions of road cars, actually, however friendly the P1 was, the GTR was even more so. I guess because that's what it was designed to do. But yeah, anyway, so yes, my school car was a McLaren P1.
Similar to the Senna launch that you and I both did at Estoril, and they warmed us up in 720Ss.
Yes. Well, why wouldn't you?
So I was building up to something with my P1 story. So I'd spent the morning at Anglesey Circuit, and then later on in the day, in the afternoon, I took the P1 and a 675LT over to the stunning roads in Snowdonia. And that just set off the day as a whole, you know, with the P1, 675LT, my favourite road in North Wales, hammering them back and forth. And I love the 675LT, but the P1 was just spectacular. I think it's got that a degree of extra rawness, the way that stones ping up, you know, into the underside of the body, into the wheel arches, and it just feels so raw and aggressive, but so drivable and approachable on the road. And I think that's probably the best drive I've ever had in a McLaren.
So you preferred the P1 to the LT?
Well, it was a more spellbinding experience.
Yeah. I mean, but there are no wrong answers here. I'd probably, and not by much, but I'd probably go the other way. Just because the LT is that much lighter and just felt a little bit more alive, I guess.
To tell the truth, the P1 that we had was McLaren's own car, P1 Uve, I think it is, yes. Isn't it? That very dark purple car. And that car has been around the block. And so when I drove it, it wasn't tight as a drum, not at all. You know, there's some play in the steering. It didn't feel like an ultra fit car, whereas the LT that we had did. So in sort of objective ways, I think the LT had an edge on it, but there's just something about the P1 experience. Perhaps it's also that even more reclined seating position that just puts you as though you're lying on your back with your feet stretched out way in front of you. It's made you feel like you're in a Group C Le Mans car.
Yeah, it's a very special thing, isn't it?
It really is. So, Andrew, your best ever drive in a McLaren then? It doesn't have to be I'll clarify this. It doesn't have to be a McLaren automotive car.
Oh, okay. Okay, so, I'm not going to bang on about road testing the F1 because...
We've done that.
We have done that, but...
That was back in episode one of the podcast, if anyone wants to find it.
Yeah, once we'd done all the numbers on the car, I did... It's a contextual thing because, you know, today, even if you drive, you know, a P1 and it's amazing, you know, there will be other stuff that you have driven, which is not a million miles away from that in terms of what it can do. In 1994, there was nothing. There was nothing, frankly, that anybody had ever driven, which was like an F1. And I got to drive it from Bruntingthorpe, where we'd done most of the numbers, up to the North Yorkshire Moors, where we were going to go and do the photo shoot. And I was alone in the car. In a McLaren F1, I was whatever I was. I was 28 years old.
Wow.
And it was the most memorable drive for all sorts of reasons. And not all of them good. You know, I can remember getting to a point where I didn't trust myself. And I can remember thinking to myself, can I really handle this thing? Have I got what it takes to control this car in a safe fashion on what was a public road with other road users? Am I sufficiently grown up not to... Because, you know, the right-hand pedal on that car, I mean, it's like mainlining something. It's, you know, it is so addictive. You can't help yourself. I can remember at the end of it, getting to the Black Swan Hotel in Helmsley and parking it outside, and the overwhelming feeling that I had at the end of that drive when I handed the keys to somebody else was just relief.
Yeah.
And to this day, that's what I feel. So that's certainly the most memorable drive I've had. I think the best one, funnily, was a race I did in a 570S GT4 at Spa the year before last. It was their first... They have a one-mate race series. And I was the journo, and I sort of bowled up. I did two races and I came second in the first one.
Good work.
And, you know, and because, you know, in one mate racing, there's nowhere to hide and, you know, it's you and a bunch of people all in the same car. And Spa is my favorite circuit to drive around, and the car was just superb. And I just had the most amazing weekend in it. And to my immense surprise, I ended up standing on a podium, so that was a fairly fun thing to do too.
I was very jealous of you when I saw you were doing that. Nothing like as jealous, actually, though, of you getting to drive an F1. And I know you've revisited that car more recently. I've sat in one, but I've never driven one. So, you know, I know the background story. I know the legend of the F1, but I don't know what it's like to drive. So, Andrew, does it steer? Does it handle? How are the brakes? I know it's got no driver aids at all. What's it like in the wet, if you've driven it in the wet? What's the central seating position like?
Okay, so the central seating position is... It might be the best thing about it, because you get in the car and you never think about it again, apart from you suddenly realise that in every other car you've driven, you adjust for the fact that it's a left or a right-hand corner, because your position relative to it, whether, depending on whether it's left or right, is different when you're sitting on one side of the car or the other. When you're in the middle, it's always the same. And it is clearly the way, in pure engineering terms, all cars should be. It is a little undignified getting in and out, and I know that some of McLaren's perhaps more elderly, more portly customers weren't that knocked out by the idea, but it's clearly absolutely the way forward. I drove... the same car I did the road test in whatever it was, 26 years ago. I drove it again last year. And with, what else did we have? We had a 720S there, we had a P1 there, and we had a Senna there. And, you know, in some regards, it hasn't aged at all. It is still blow your mind fast. You simply won't believe how quickly this thing gets from one place to another. And people look at the figures and they'll say, oh, well, it's only 6.3 seconds from 0 to 100. You know, forgetting no launch control, no traction control. You've got to do this thing called changing gear. And also, you know, and you're on tyres, which frankly might have been made, might as well be made out of wood compared to the tyres that, you know, that you're, that you'll get on a Senna or something like that. So, you know, that 6.3 0 to 100 time, you know, translate, if it had had all the advantages that modern cars had, it would be, what would it be, a mid-low 5, something like that. So that's how quick that car really is. The engine, I would say the best engine ever fitted to a road car. The way that it pulls, the noise that it makes, the power that it delivers, the... I mean, it is, well, as I said earlier, it is like mainlining something. It is utterly addictive. And in a way that, you know, however good, however powerful some, you know, modern twin turbo hybridized V8 might be, I mean, come on. You know, that 6.1 litre V12 was a masterpiece of engineering. And, you know, I'll never forget it. I will. And to go get back in it again 25 years after the last time you did, and for it to have diminished not one degree in that time just shows you what, I mean, goodness knows what it must have felt like when I first drove it. I mean, I would love to be back in that car experiencing that engine for the first time all over again. Yeah.
Is it a physical car to drive? That, I mean, no drive rays, no power steering?
It is a very physical car to drive. You know, it's quite soft. In fact, by modern car standards, it's very soft. Obviously, no power steering. I mean, beautiful steering. But, you know, the handling does feel, you know, of its age. It was in the dry, it was, you know, it was a very capable car in its day because it was light and it had big tyres on it and it was very low and, it, you know, and its suspension geometry was pretty good. So, you know, all those boxes were ticked. But today, you know, you notice the way that the car rolls, you notice that, you know, obviously that the tyres have nothing like the grip of a modern car. So it's a car to enjoy the handling of for the feel of it. I mean, the feel is still superb, but ultimately, you know, on the limit, it's not going to, you know, have the poise, the damping, the accuracy that you get from a modern car. The only area in which I would say it was deficient these days, and frankly it probably was when it was newer, the brakes. Given the performance potential, I mean, you know, in 1994 I would say that it had, you know, pretty good brakes for a supercar, but this wasn't a supercar, this was the world's first hypercar, and the brakes felt, I would guess, they probably felt adequate then. They don't anymore. They just, you know, and you've really, really got to take that into account. Because to be honest with you, they are not quite up to the job. In the wet, I did drive one in the wet. We had to shoot the cover somewhere down in the south of England. And I drove a customer car in the wet. And I found that quite focusing, I think is the word. others have found it somewhat more so and have had some fairly enormous accidents as a result. Yeah, not something to take liberties with in the wet at all.
I can imagine. Wow. Well, I'm going to have to imagine, aren't I? Because I'm unlikely to drive one anytime soon, unless we've got a very friendly DN listener with a McLaren F1. Please get in touch.
Yes. I mean, McLaren, it has to be said, for this big thing that we did with Autocar with it last year, I mean, they did recommission XP5, which had been sat not doing very much for a while. And they did get it going again for us. And they were unbelievably accommodating and trusting, given that we insured it for £25 million, and they were there. They saw exactly what we were doing with it, and nobody batted an eyelid all day. We drove it. Okay, we didn't drive it probably quite as fast as we possibly could, because that didn't seem appropriate. But we certainly put it through its paces. You know, I think I did 160, 170 miles an hour in it. So that car is there, and it does work. So, you know, maybe if somebody at McLaren, or if we can think of a reason to go to McLaren with an idea, then maybe your time may yet come.
Okay, well, I'll spend the rest of the day dreaming up some reason
and the weekend if I were you.
Okay, well, we need to start winding this podcast down, but I think we should do that by not looking back, but looking forwards. What do you make of the McLarens that are on their way? I'm thinking specifically Speedtail and Elva.
Speedtail and Elva, fine. I'm more interested in the Speedtail because I think that's it's an amazing looking car, and I'm really interested in the idea of a proper luxury McLaren. But they are, you know, and I think even McLaren would admit that these are sideshows. They're not, you know, the mainstream products. You know, we know that McLaren are going to stop producing their twin turbo V8 in time, and that they're going to go over to a twin turbo V6 with some kind of hybrid drive attached to it, and I'm very interested to see how that works out. I'm very interested to see how McLaren can go over to a car which will obviously need to have, you know, electric motors and batteries and all that sort of thing, and still stay true to their mantra of, you know, weight being the enemy of all, because they're absolutely right, and it is, and they need to absolutely stick to that. You know, we can't get into the, you know, a situation where you've got, you know, McLaren sports cars weighing, you know, 1,600-1,700 kilos. So, you know, I'm fascinated to see how they square that particular circle. I also want to see them break out beyond. I mean, every single McLaren that they've produced in the last 10 years, whatever its purpose, has been a two-seat mid-engine carbon tub car with a twin-turbo V8 running through a seven-speed double-clutch gearbox. You know, I would like to see McLaren do, you know, a front-engine GT, if I'm honest with you, or certainly do a 2+2. And as we all know, you know, 2+2 cars with mid-engine configurations are really, really difficult to do just because of the amount of stuff you've got to stick between the wheelbase. And that's before you start thinking about, you know, where you're going to put your battery pack and where you're going to put your electric motors and that sort of thing. So it is just easier if you do it the other way around. So I'm fascinated by where McLaren goes next. I think McLaren is getting to the stage now where it's got to take the next step, and it's got to break out of you know, the comfortable place it's been making, you know, these wonderful cars. But, you know, I think that there is a perception that McLaren has done very successfully, you know, probably much of what can be done with the current recipe. You know, maybe as an as well as opposed to an instead of, I'd just like to see something completely different from them. And I think, you know, for me, I don't see at all why, I can see absolutely why McLaren should never and could never do, let us say, an SUV. I think that would be horrendous, particularly at this time for a McLaren, for a company like McLaren. But a really, really beautiful sporting front engine 2+2. Yeah, why not?
Why not? Yeah, completely agree. I'd love to see that. Okay, well, let's wrap things up then. We'll have to wait and see if the bottom really has fallen out the used supercar market, or if we're looking at a COVID-19 induced blip. I suppose over the coming months we'll find out. But there we go. Let's leave it there, Andrew. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh,
everybody,
you
listening, everybody listening. Please remember to leave some feedback wherever you get your podcast, rate it, and please do subscribe as well to the Drive Nation podcast if you can. It helps us, and hopefully it helps you to find them and never miss an episode. Now, Andrew, if I say one final word on McLaren, you're going to say, I want to go and drive one now, aren't you?
Yes, but that kind of never changes. You know, yes, please. Ready when you are.
Yeah, former Q. Okay, well, we'll speak to you all again next week. Andrew, thank you for your time.
Dan, thank you. And everybody out there, many thanks for tuning in, listening to us. And yeah, we'll be back again this time next week to do it all over again.
Yep. Bye, everyone.
Cheers.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra.
and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.